The book of Judges covers a great deal of history. It's been estimated anything from 350 to 400 years. Joshua had been a leader for 50 years or so. He lived to a ripe old age. But when he died, there was this long period of the Jewish tribes settling the land. The book of Joshua starts out by saying that Joshua is dead. After the death of Joshua. Actually, it's sort of interesting because that's how the book of Joshua starts out. It says, Joshua 1:1 starts out that after the death of Moses. Well, the book of Joshua, Judges starts out after the book of after the death of Joshua. The difference is that in Joshua 1:1, after the death of Moses, the Lord said to Joshua. But in the book of Judges, after the death of Joshua, there's nobody. There's nobody there to bring strong central leadership. So Judges 1:1, Joshua is dead. In chapter 2, verse 6, Joshua is alive again. Now, there's no resurrection. It's just that there's a bit of a flashback here. And in chapter 2, verse 6, the writer of Judges is going back and helping to explain why things are as they were. What they said is Joshua lived to a ripe old age, and as long as he was alive and the elders who outlived him, the people followed the Lord. But after his death, there became real problems. And so by the time you get to chapter 2, verse 8, Joshua is dead and there's no successor. And then things change greatly. There are some big changes that take place after the death of Joshua and the passing away of that generation. From the beginning, as the tribes began to occupy the land, the occupation was at best a loose federation. You'll notice we provide you with a graphic which shows not one nation, but actually 12 tribes. Very loosely linked together. When they sat down at the table at Gilgal and divided and allocated the land, that seemed to, in some ways, imprint the idea that the tribes would act on their own and act separately. At least that's what happened because there was no central leadership. It is true that some of the tribes worked together, and so early on in the book of Judges, we read about Judah going out, and we're going to go out and drive these people out of this land that God has given us, and we're going to settle it. And they say to the Simeonites, hey, you guys want to go with us? If you'll go help us, then we'll help you. And so Judah and Simeon send their men out, and they do battle. They go to Bezek, and they do battle, and they chase down this king, Adonai Bezek. And when they catch hold of him, they cut off his thumbs and his big toes. You would think that this would really annoy Adonai Bezek. But you talk about a tough guy. He says, huh, he said, so you cut off my thumbs and my big toes? He said, look, I've had 70 kings whose thumbs and big toes I cut off grabbing crumbs from under my table. Boy, oh boy, there's a tough guy for you, isn't it? Well, some of the tribes began to help each other and they went out to take the land that had been allocated to them. But as early as chapter 1 and verse 27, there's an ominous refrain. They did not drive them out. That is, these people who were occupying the land, and they'd been told to. They never drove them out, we read again. Or, nor did the Ephraimites drive out the Canaanites. So they went in and they occupied the land, and they forced their way in. But they didn't drive these people that were living in those areas out. And it's going to turn out to be a terrible mistake. Not only because they disobeyed God, but because of the repercussions in their own national life. Now, this early government nation was not a unified nation. There was no king in the land, we're told over and over again. That is, everyone did that which is right in his own eyes. When I read that, I don't think just individuals, but I think corporately as well, that every tribe did what was good for them. In the early days of the United States after the Revolutionary War, we founded what we called a confederation under the Articles of Confederation. Most people think 1776, we won the Revolutionary War against the British. We put George Washington in as president, and we lived happily ever after. But that's not how it happened. Washington didn't come in as president until some 13 years later. And the reason was that we were a federation, and each state could do its own thing. In fact, a state could charge tariff for somebody coming from another state, and it wasn't working. And so the United States developed a constitution for a republic and changed its government. Well, this early government in the land is a confederation. There was some cooperation between the tribes, but also a great deal of competition. Characteristics of the confederation, that there was no central leadership. There was no one. There was no office. There was no means to draw these people together. They did not have the leadership they'd had under Moses and Joshua. And then, to make things worse, we read that there's a generation that came forth. This is after Joshua died and the elders who were part of his generation. We read that a generation came who two things. They didn't know the Lord. Well, that's sad, isn't it? They didn't know the Lord or the work he'd done for Israel. They didn't know their history. What happened to the idea that when they saw the pile of stones, they were supposed to say, why are these stones here? And they were to have their history reiterated. They should have known that it was the Lord who brought us up out of Egypt. They ought to know those things, but they didn't know what the Lord had done for them. And there was no king in the land. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. I spent 10 of my years in East Africa. Over there, we called this tribalism. That's one of the problems in countries where a colonial government drew boundaries that are not taking into account the tribes. So you have tribes here and there, and they all of a sudden they're thrown together in supposedly one nation. Elections are a difficulty. If you have multi-party systems, sometimes the party is all tribal. And so the election split the country, not only ideologically, because the people running for office differ, but it splits it by tribe, which is a terrible thing. So in some places, Kenya, for example, they tried a one-party system so that the competition would be from within each tribe who would represent the government, the one government, the one party in the parliament. But tribalism is a terrible thing. You take Somalia. The Somalians are all of the same same ethnic background. They're all Hamites. They're all Muslims. They're all Sunni Muslims. They all speak the same language. They are a homogeneous group. And why have they been killing themselves the way they have? Why has there been this warfare that has turned that nation into just a place of destruction? Well, the clans are fighting. Even though they had so much in common, they still acted for their independent interest. And that's what we have happening here. Now, the content of the book of Judges starts with an introduction and then tells us about the judges. The introduction tells about the unconquered areas, and there's where we learn about Adonai Bezek and the fact that the people weren't being driven out. And we read about the tribalism that I just told you about. And there is also in chapter 2, 10 to 19, a description of a historical cycle that took place over and over through the hundreds of years of this period. And it's very simple. It starts out by saying that the people forgot the Lord. They held on to idols. They intermingled and intermarried with the folks that they shouldn't have. They didn't hold fast to the Lord or love Him or pay attention to His book. And as a result, disaster came usually from these other nations. they began to be oppressed and conquered and abused by the folks from Mesopotamia, from the Moabites, the Philistines, the people up in northern Palestine got into it, the people from Media, the Ammonites, sometimes a combination. There were a time when the Ammonites and the Philistines gathered together and they kind of divided it and they went, and because the people were divided, not one nation, but a group of tribes, they couldn't withstand this. And they'd, of course, forgotten the Lord. And so they'd find themselves oppressed by these people. And then they'd turn and they'd call out to God for help. And God, in His goodness, would deliver them by providing a judge. The judge was not a king. He was a deliverer. And he would help to deliver the people from that oppression of those nations that had taken advantage of the weakness of the people. But no sooner would they get delivered and God would deliver them that they'd breathe a sigh of relief, whew, and they'd go right back to their disobedience, to their sin, to their rebellion, to their idolatry. And of course, when they drifted down into sin and disobedience, they would begin to be oppressed by these outside nations. They'd be conquered, abused, there'd be all kinds of disaster. They'd cry to the Lord for help, and the Lord would raise up a judge, and the judge would help to deliver them, and the people would breathe a sigh of relief, and then they'd start sinning and being disobedient. And that cycle happens over and over and over again through the book. Now, let's talk briefly about the judges. Well, we better talk about them. That's what this book is all about. Let's see. There was Othniel and Ehud and Shamgar and Deborah and Barak and Gideon. Know him well. Tola and Jair and Jephthah and Izbar and Elon and Abdon and Samson and Eli and later on it's going to be Samuel. What were these fellows like? Well, they're certainly interesting. This is another good book for junior highs. It's a violent book. It's a rough book. Chapter 3 tells about Ehud. Ehud was a Benjaminite at a time when the Moabites were oppressing his people with a big, fat king named King Eglon, the Moabite king. And Ehud came down with a group of people to give tribute to King Eglon. Sire, here is this wealth. It's for you. And they started to leave, and then Ehud said to his companions, well, look, you go on. I have a secret message for Eglon. So he goes back, and he goes in. Oh, yes, King Eglon, aren't you the man who just brought me the tribute? Yes, sir. Yeah, I have a secret message for you. Well, I suppose Eglon thought there was something really good in for him, so he cleared the room. And Ehud went up, and he bowed before the king. But Ehud was left-handed. He was left-handed. And as he bowed, he drew out this big knife or sword, and he plunged it into the belly of Eglon. I told you that junior high kids love it. So far that the handle was buried in his stomach, but the point came out the back, and he just left it in there. Eglon collapsed. Ehud left himself, locked the door, slipped out the back way. By the way, for you left-handers, the Hebrew says that he was deformed in his right hand. Now, he wasn't, that was idiomatic. That was how they describe left-handers. A left-hander is somebody who's deformed in his right hand. But you know, he was a Benjaminite. And the Benjaminites, it ran genetically. Do you know that the Benjaminites had a core of 700 left-handed warriors? Did you know that? And these 700 left-handed warriors are so good that with a sling, they could hit a hair with the stone. So left-handedness ran in the family. Oh, there are a lot of interesting stories in the Judges. By the way, after he let himself out, all these court attendants stood outside the door just waiting and waiting, and they said, well, shouldn't we go in? And he, well, he got the door locked. You know, he's probably going to the toilet. And that's what the Bible says. And so, And so they don't know what to do. Finally, of course, they break in. By that time, there is the dead body of the king. It causes terrific disruption. There's a rout. And so that's Ehud the judge. He didn't do a whole lot of ruling, but he did delivering. He delivered something certainly to Eglon. Oh, the judges are so interesting. Although I think perhaps the person in the book of Judges who demonstrates the greatest grasp on wisdom is Delilah, that wicked, shrewd and nasty woman who really has wisdom when she says to Samson, "Oh, Samson, how can you say that you love me when your heart is so far from me?" Boy, she said a mouthful. Now, she, of course, didn't love him either. But how can you say you love me when your heart is so far from me? Could be an indictment on the people during this period of time. But let's talk about the judges. It's important that we understand who they were. First of all, the judges were deliverers. They were local. When you go back and you look carefully, you find that the judges were not national in scope. Deborah and Barak, for example, who certainly were great judges, their deliverance and judging was directed towards 6 of the 12 tribes. Gideon, his work was among 4 tribes. Later, a 5th tribe was brought in. Jephthah, his work was only towards Gad and Manasseh, I think. Only 2 tribes. So first of all, these judges were local. Secondly, they were occasional. There wasn't a steady stream of them. When there was deliverance, then they'd go off the scene. There was no judge. There was no king. There was no judge. Everybody did what was right in their own eyes. Not only were they local and occasional, but the judges themselves were definitely temporary. When they'd done the delivering, they went off the scene. Even when, for example, that Gideon was being persuaded, "Now stay on and be our ruler." He had real questions about that. These were not hereditary people, and they didn't take an office that they kept over a period of time. So the time of the judges is local, occasional, and temporary. On the graphic where we've shown the 12 tribes being very separate, a confederation, we've noted the judges by linking together 3 or 4 of those tribes and saying they were local, they were occasional, they were temporary. Well, I want to give you some idea from the book of Judges what the land was like, because we have 3 pictures, 3 flashbacks at the end of the book that tell us the state of the nation of Israel. The first of the flashbacks takes place up in the hills of Ephraim. And up in the hills of Ephraim, there's a young fellow named Micah. And you know, Micah's mother lost 1,100 shekels of silver. That's a lot of money. It disappeared. Oh, she doesn't know what happened to it. Well, Micah did, because he'd stolen it. But his conscience got the better of him. And he went to his mom and he said, "Mom, I'm the thief." And she says, "Oh, the Lord bless you, my son. And, oh, good. And I've got to do something good with this money that you've returned." So she takes 200 of the silver shekels and she sends it to the craftsmen, and they make a carved image, an idol. And they set up a shrine in the house with the idol and with the ephod, which is the priest's uniform. And she says, "Son, you're such a good boy. You be the priest." Now, he wasn't a Levite. He's a lay person. He's a layman. He has no right being the priest. Well, we're told just about that time in the story in chapter 17, there was no king in the land. Everybody did what was right in their own eyes. Well, after a while, a Levite comes by, a wandering Levite, looking for work. He's from Bethlehem. And he says, "I'm looking for a place to stay." And Micah says, "You're a Levite? I mean, you're a real priest?" "Oh, yeah." "Well, why don't you be my father and priest? Why don't you stay and we'll hire you? For 10 shekels and your food and clothing, you can be our priest. We'll have a real priest for our idol." And Micah says, now I know the Lord is good to me. Well, there was no king in the land. Everybody did what was right in their own eyes. And about this time, five Danites show up. These Danites are looking out to try to find a place for the tribe of Dan to settle. And these five Danites come around, and they stop by. They're exploring and spying, and they spend the night there at the house of Micah. And they say, well, Levite, what are you doing here? Hey, well, I'm the priest here. And hey, it's great. And they saw this idol and all this stuff. And they said, inquire of the Lord. And we're thinking of going up here. And he said, sure, go up there to Lachish. The priest says, go up to Lachish. That's a good place. So they do. They go up there and they find a secure and prosperous and unprotected people. So the Danites go back home, get 600 warriors. We've been warned way back in Genesis that Dan is like a snake in the path. He's tough. The 600 Danites are going to go up there, and they're going to destroy the people of Lachish. But along the way, they camp near the house of Micah. And the fellows who had been on the first trip said, do you know what's in there? That guy's got this really expensive idol, and he's got... So they go in. And the priest said, oh, hi, fellas, welcome back. What can I do for you? We're taking this. We're taking the idol. We're taking all this idol, this wealth. You want to go with us? Oh, yeah, he says. I mean, his job's going to be ruined. So Micah gets up, and these guys, they start moving off. The 600 men, and they've got the priest, and they've got the ephod, and they've got the idol and the wealth. And Micah finds out, and he and some of his neighbors go, hey, you guys, ho, ho. And they look back at him, and they say, yeah, what's with you? Well, this is not, you got a problem? You better be quiet, you know. Some of us, we have some of our fellows who have a really bad temper. Micah knows that he can't fight that. So they go off. They get to those people of Lachish. They wipe them out. They set up in Dan, a place to worship the idol. And for the rest of the history of Israel, the northern part of the country, Dan is a place to go to worship the idol. Whew. So the first thing we see in our state of the nation is that there's just gross idolatry going on. By gross idolatry, I mean the idolatry seems to be just so casual. You know, there's no talk about the Lord. And, you know, this is not the pagans. These are people who are supposed to be God's people. There's no unity. There's no king. Then they don't know the Lord. They don't know his works. They don't know his word. Joshua had told them, hold fast to the book. They'd stopped keeping the Passover. Every man did that which is right in his own eyes. Well, then in chapter 19, 20, and 21... we have another flashback, the Levite and his concubine. Another Levite marries this girl, arrangement with her concubine, and she doesn't like him or something's wrong. She goes home to daddy. So he goes finally to find her and bring her back. Oh, his father-in-law, he wants to get rid of this woman. Yeah. And so he wines and dines them for 3 days, and the Levite says, look, we got to go. It's a long trip up there, so I'll take my concubine, your daughter, and off we'll go. And they're about to go, and the dad says, oh, no, why don't you stay and have one quick drink? And let's have a little bite to eat before you go. Have one. Come on, let's have a drink. Well, they do. They drink, and they drink, and they drink, and they eat all day, and it's too late to go. So the next day, he gets up all ready to go. He says, hey, come on, let's have a drink, the daddy says. Come on, have one for the road. And they eat, and it gets late. He says, come on, yes, well, I'll stay another day. He said, no, I got to get home. So they leave, but they leave late. And because they leave late, they don't know where they're going to spend the night. And they pass by the city of the Jebusites. Jebu, this is the pagans. They say, oh, we're not going to stay there. So they go on a little later, and they go on to Gibeah in the tribe of Benjamin. And they're there in the city square wondering what to do when an old man comes. He's from Ephraim, and he's come from the fields. He says, where are you going? Where are you from? And, hey, well, why don't you come and stay with me? And they said, well, we're okay. We have straw and fodder and bread and wine. But we'd love to have a place to stay. Well, you're welcome in my house. Don't spend the night in the square. So they got there. He took care of the donkey. He washed their feet. And they were eating and drinking and enjoying the evening when there's a pounding on the door. And it's people from the neighborhood, from the town. They say, hey, we hear you have this man here, this stranger. Bring him out. We want to have sex with him. Okay, guy says, I can't do that. These are my guests. Bring them out or else we'll break in. Well, I've got my virgin daughter and we got this concubine. Won't they do? And what they do is they open the door and they throw the concubine out. And the concubine is raped and abused all through the night. And very early in the morning, she crawls up to the door of the house. And in the morning when they open the door, there is her dead body. The Levite takes her body and chops it up into pieces and sends pieces throughout all of Israel to the various tribes. And he said his message was, there has never been such a thing done since we left Egypt. We got to do something about it. Consider, what should you do? And the Israelites band together and they get an army together and they go up against the Benjaminites and they get whipped. And they go up again against the Benjaminites and they get whipped again. And those 700 left-handers are cutting them up. But finally, after a long campaign, they look to the Lord. They go up there. They win a big victory. They lure the Benjaminites into a trap. And they nearly wipe the Benjaminites out, so only a few hundred Benjaminites get away. And then all of a sudden, the people have second thoughts. See, they had promised that nobody would marry their daughters to these Benjaminites. But here are this handful of Benjaminites left and no daughters. Nobody to marry. And they couldn't be the end of one of the tribes. And but nobody has come down from Jabesh-Gilead to help in the fight. So they go up to Jabesh-Gilead, grab hold of some women and take them down. And say to the Benjaminites, here you are, some wives. We don't want the tribe to disappear. And there's still not enough. So they arrange a party in another area where the girls are out dancing. And they arrange it for the Benjaminites to come and steal the girls. When the local people complain, they say, well, really, got to do something for these Benjaminites. Wow. What a messy story. Now look, folks, this is not the pagans. They could have stayed with the Jebusites. This is God's people. There's no unity. There's no king. They didn't know the Lord or his works or his word. They weren't keeping Passover. Every man did that which is right in his own eyes. This is gross immorality. It seemed like a common thing. Send that man out so we can have sex with him. And on your graphic, we've put two nasty little scribbles across those 10 tribes, that federation. Because what marked the days of the judges? Gross immorality and gross idolatry. And because there's a third flashback. And we want to take a look at the third flashback in Judges chapters 22 to 25. But we'll wait until our next session. And we'll talk about that third flashback, another flashback that tells us something about what it was like in the days when the judges judged Israel.